kids pitching rocks. He threw one out. It went arcing through the air down off the bluff and sent a small white geyser up in the lake, the plunk coming back to him a moment later. Pretty good, if he did say it himself. The storm out there was towering up a bit higher, grayish-black, a bit ugly. He glanced toward the mine site and found the tri-wheeler had almost arrived. It stopped. For a moment, Johnny did not recognize the rider, and he stepped nearer to him, questioningly. Then he saw it was the third duplicate of him, a man they called Stormalong. His real name was Stam Stavanger, member of a Norwegian group who had emigrated to Scotland from Norway in ages past, and who had preserved their names and lineage, but not their customs. They looked and acted like Scots. He was Johnny's height and build and had eyes like Johnny's, but his hair was a shade darker and his skin very much more tanned. Since the load days, he had not bothered to keep up the resemblance and had cut his beard square at the bottom. Stormalong had stayed at the academy. A skilled pilot, he enjoyed teaching the new cadets to fly. He had found an ancient flying coat, a white scarf, and a huge pair of goggles from a bygone age, and he affected these. They gave him a bit of dash. They swatted each other on the back and grinned at each other. "They told me I'd find you down here throwing rocks at the crocs," said Stormalong. "How's the arm?" "You must have seen the last one I threw," said Johnny. "It might not have knocked down one of these elephants, but it's getting there." He guided him over to a big, flat rock overlooking the lake, and they sat down. The storm was building up, but it was an easy run back. Stormalong was seldom very talkative, but right now he was full of news. It had taken some ferreting out, real badger digging, to find where Johnny was. Nobody knew in America, so he had gone to Scotland to find him or some trace of him. Chrissy sent her love. He'd already given patties to Biddy. The chief of Clan Fergus had sent his respects, mind you, not his regards, but his respects. His Aunt Ellen sent her love. She was married to the parson now and in Scotland. He'd gotten on Johnny's trail through the two coordinators who'd gone back to Scotland, the one sent out to bring in some tribe or other, the Brigades, the Brigantes. Oh, that mob was up in Denver now. Horrible people. He'd seen some. Anyway, they'd brought Allison's body home for burial, and Scotland was in an uproar over the murder of Allison. But that wasn't what he wanted to tell Johnny. The craziest thing had happened on his flight over. "You know," said Stormalong, "how you said we could get invaded again here on Earth? Well, it does seem possible." He'd been coming over to Scotland on the North Great Circle, flying an ordinary battle plane, making good time. And just as he reached the northern tip of Scotland, right there on his view screen, and visual as well, he had seen the biggest, most enormous craft he ever hoped to see. For a moment, he thought he was running into it and would crash right then. There it was on his screens and through his windshield. But bang! He hit it, but it wasn't there.
"Not there?" asked Johnny.
Well, that was exactly it. He'd run into a solid object that wasn't there. Right in the sky, mind you. Big as all the sky, but not there. Here, he had the screen pictures in this pack. Johnny looked at it. It was a sphere with a ring around it. Nothing like any ship he had ever heard of. And it looked huge. In fact, at the corner, the Orkney Islands were visible. It looked like it reached from mid-Scotland to the Orkneys. The next consecutive picture showed it enveloping the battle plane, taking the shot, and the third one showed it was gone.
"The ship that wasn't there," said Stormalong.
"Light," said Johnny, suddenly recalling some man theories. "This thing could have been going faster than light. It left its image behind. That's a guess, you know, but I read that they thought that things that went faster than light could look as big as the whole universe. It's in some texts on nuclear physics we had. I didn't understand most of it."
"Well, that just could be," said Stormalong, "because the old woman said it wasn't that big."
"The old woman?" "Well, it's like this. When he had gotten over his scare, he had backtracked his screen recorders. He hadn't noticed it in approaching Scotland. You know how it is, you get groggy on a long flight, not alert, and he hadn't had much sleep lately, cadets being what they were, slow to graduate, when desperately needed by the overloaded pilots. The backtrack of the screens showed this little trace coming up from a farm west of Kinlochbervie. You know, on the northwest coast of Scotland, that little place? Well, he cranked down his speed and went into that spot, expecting maybe the place had been raided or shot up. But there was just a burned spot in the rocks. A farm raises mostly rocks around there, and he didn't see any other damage or hostile force, so he landed near the house. An old woman came out, all fluttery about two callers from the sky in one day, when she didn't usually see anybody for months on end. And he was made to sit down and have some yarb tea, and she showed him this new shiny pocket knife. "A pocket knife?" said Johnny. This ordinarily very quiet Norwegian Scot was taking his time about getting down to it. Well, yes, they'd seen some in ruined cities, remember? They folded in on themselves. Only this one was shiny as could be. Yes, I am getting on with it. So anyway, according to what the old woman told him, there she was, combing her dog, that often got burrs in him, and it almost startled her witless. Standing right behind her was a small gray man. And right behind him was a big gray sphere with a ring around it, parked right where the cow was usually staked out. "Like to have frightened her silly daft," she said. There hadn't been a sound. Maybe only a bit of wind. So she asked the small gray man in for a cup of yarb tea, just like she asked me, except that I'd had the manners to come down roaring and announcing myself. But the small gray man was very pleasant. He looked a bit smaller than most men. His skin was gray, his hair was gray, and his suit was gray. The only thing odd about him was that he had a box he wore on a strap around his neck and hung on his chest. He'd say something to this box, and then, presently, the box would speak English. The small gray man's voice was quiet and had different tones, and the box only had one tone, a monotone. "A vocoder," said Johnny, "a portable translation device. A cyclotext describes them, but the cyclos don't use them." Well, all right. But anyway, this small gray man asked her whether she had any newspapers. And no, because of course she'd never seen a newspaper. Few people have. And then he asked her whether she had any history books, and she was disappointed to have to tell him she had heard of a book but didn't have any. Well, apparently he thought she didn't understand, so the small gray man made a lot of motions to indicate something printed on paper was what he wanted. So she got very helpful. Seems like somebody had bought some wool from her and given her a couple of those new credits in exchange, and explained what they were.
"What credits?"
"Oh, you haven't seen them." And Stormalong fished in his pockets and found one. "They pay us now, with these." It was a one-credit note from the new planetary bank, and Johnny looked at it with casual interest. Then his attention riveted on the picture. A picture of him, waving a gun. He didn't think it was all that good a likeness, and also it embarrassed him a bit. "So anyway," Stormalong went on, "the old woman had accepted them because of the picture of you, and she had one of them on the wall. And she sold it to the small gray man for the pocket knife because she had another one she could put on the wall."
"I should think that was a cheap price for the pocket knife, if it was as fancy as you say," said Johnny.
Well, Stormalong hadn't thought about that. But anyway, the small gray man finished his yarb tea and put the banknote away very carefully between two pieces of metal and put them in an inside pocket, and then he thanked her and went back to the ship and said something to somebody inside and got in. He called back for the old woman not to come close and shut the door. And then there was a curl of flame and it rose up, and then all of a sudden it got as big as the whole sky and vanished. Yes, as Johnny said, probably a phenomenon of light. But it didn't fly like our ships, and it didn't teleport. It didn't seem to be cyclo, what with the man being a small gray man. Johnny had become very quiet. Some other alien race? Interested in Earth now that the cyclos weren't here? He looked across the lake, puzzling about it. The storm was building even higher. Well, be that as it may, continued Stormalong, that wasn't why he was here. He fumbled in a flat case he carried for maps.
It's a letter from Care, said Stormalong.
And he said I had to bring it personally and not let it get out of my hands. I owe him favors, and he said if you didn't get it, the whole shaft would fall in. Here it is. 4. Johnny regarded the envelope. It was the paper cover used to package anti-heat shields. The only writing on it was Awful Secret. He held it up to the light, darkening now as the storm drew nearer. It had no explosive in it that he could detect. He ripped it open. Ah, it was Kerr's writing, all right. The semi-literate curved hooks and loops might not spell correctly, but they spelled Kerr's idea of a cycloalphabet. He opened it up all the way to read it. It said, Awful Secret. To you know who. As you know, personal letters are forbidden by company policy, and if I was caught writing and sending one, it would cost me 3 months' pay, ha-ha. But you said before you left I should write you if a certain thing happened, and give it to a pilot like you-know-who to bring to you fast. So no names, as names is out security. But it is going to happen, so I am writing you even if the company docks me 3 months' pay. Notice this handwriting is disguised, too. Yesterday, that flunked-out ex-pilot Knothead Lars, the one who thought he was the world's greatest combat acrobatic pilot, from talking to a party I won't mention because of out-security. Security, get it? And broke his silly neck and got promoted to assistant to you-know-who? No names. Come down and asked all the cyclos they got in stir to fix up the breathe gas pumps and ventilators in you-know-who's old office. Well, they won't cooperate, as I knew and you knew they wouldn't. They believe, and I am sure they are drilling straight in, that you-know-who killed old you-know-who by murder. Another one that was murdered afterward had figured it out and told them just before the semi-annual firing, and then he got missing down the shaft, so they believe it. They ain't going to do a thing for you-know-who, or have anything to do with you-know-who's old quarters, because the cyclos are sure you-know-who would blow them up. So anyway, the breathe gas pumps and circulators in that section are all blown to bits, as we both know, and before anybody can go to work in there without a mask, they have to be fixed, but they are broke. So this crazy idiot, the universe's greatest combat pilot that never was in combat and broke his neck and we couldn't train, come over to see me, and I said, yes, I could fix up the offices of you-know-who, but I would need certain parts, maybe even from other mine sites, because the breathe gas pump is so broke. And he said it was a council order, and he could make sure I got what I needed. So I am drawing up a very fancy repair design that needs lots of parts, and I am delaying as long as I can. They said you-know-who on the council said it was secret and urgent, and they're going to ride me to get it done and pay me extra pay. Ha ha. So I am stalling, and like you said, you better get over here, as I told them I needed assistance. But don't use your name, as anything to do with you-know-who and you-know-who is poison gas in the drift. So there, you know now, and I have about wore my paw out writing this, and my ears out listening to how rush it is, but I will delay and look for unnecessary parts as long as I can for the breathe gas circulator that sure was broke, and is now even more broke. Ha ha. This personal letter could cost me 3 months' pay. Ha ha. So you owe me if I'm caught at it. Ha ha. You know who. Addition. Claw this letter up so it don't cost me 3 months' pay or my furry neck. No ha ha. Johnny read the letter again and then, as required, tore it into bits. When was this given to you? He asked Stormalong. Yesterday morning. I had to trace you. Johnny looked out across the lake. The storm was huge now, towering with black turmoil. It was almost upon them. Johnny pushed Stormalong onto the tri-wheeler and started it up. Without another word, he tore across the savannah to the mine site. The growl of thunder sounded, and the first stinging slashes of rain lanced the air. Johnny knew he had to get to America now, at once. 5. That's a trap, said Robert the Fox.
Johnny had returned. He rapidly told them what Kerr had said. He had given orders for the immediate refueling, checkover, and cleaning of Stormalong's plane to be ready within the hour. He had the co-pilot who had come with Stormalong in front of him now, with Angus standing nearby, and he was comparing the two. "Can you trust Kerr?" demanded Sir Robert. Johnny didn't answer. He was satisfied Angus could be mistaken for the co-pilot if he darkened his beard, put on a bit of walnut stain, and changed clothes.
"Answer me. I cannot think you've got all your wits."
Robert was so agitated he was pacing back and forth in the underground room Johnny had been using. He was even lapsing into his colloquial Scott dialect. "I must go, now and fast," Johnny shot at them.
"No,"
said Dunnell Dean.
"No," said Robert the Fox.
There was a flurry of translations with his coordinator, and then Colonel Ivan shouted, "Nyet!" Johnny had Angus changing clothes with the co-pilot.
"You don't have to go, Angus," he said. "You said yes too hastily."
Angus said, "I'll go. I'll say my prayers and make my will, but I'll go with you, Johnny."
Stormalong was standing there, and Johnny pulled him over to a huge cyclo mirror and stood beside him. Tropic sun had tanned Johnny lately. Their skin tone difference was not so great now. Stormalong's beard was a little darker. Some walnut stain would fix that. There was the new facial scar, well healed now, that Johnny had gotten. Nothing could be done about that, and he hoped people would think Stormalong had had an accident. Yes, wait. He could put a bandage on it. Ah, the square cut of the bottom of the beard. That was what was making the difference. He reached for the toolkit Angus always carried, got out some sharp wire snips, and began to make his beard exactly the same as Stormalong's. That done, he changed clothes with him. Now a little walnut stain in the beard. Good. He looked at himself in the mirror. Ah, yes, the piece of bandage. He got that and put it on. Now? Good. He could pass for Stormalong. The huge old-fashioned goggles, white scarf, and leather flying coat. Yes, they did it. Unless he was looked at too closely, or their slight difference in accent was heard. He made Stormalong talk, then he talked. No Scott Burr in Stormalong's accent. Scott University? A little soft in pronunciation? He tried it. Yes, he could also sound like Stormalong. The others were very agitated. The big Russian was cracking the knuckles of his huge hands. Biddy McLeod was peering into the room. He came forward, his eyes bright with pleading. "No," said Johnny. "Pride or no pride, this mission had death in it. You cannot come with me." Then he softened. "Take good care of Colonel Ivan." Biddy swallowed and backed up. Angus had finished and run out. The clang of cartridges being changed and the whir of a drill sounded from the hangar where they were readying the plane. Johnny beckoned to Colonel Ivan. He and his coordinator came forward. "Get the American underground base closed, Colonel. Every door, so no one can enter but us. Close it so hard they'll never get into it. Do the same thing with the tactical and nuclear weapons area 30 miles to the north. Seal it. Secure every assault rifle not in use by Scots. Have you got it?" The colonel had a group there now. Yes, he got it. Johnny beckoned to Dunnell Dean and Sir Robert, and they kept pace with him as he went toward their commissary. Johnny, in terse, brief statements, told them exactly what to do to carry on if he were killed. They were very sober, worried for him. The hairbreadth daring of his plan left an awful lot of room for slip-ups. But they got it. They said they would carry on. "And Dunnell Dean," concluded Johnny, "I want you over at the Academy in America in about 24 hours, coming in from Scotland to take over the pilot training duties of Stormalong, who by then, with luck, will be on other assignment." For once, Dunnell Dean just nodded assent. The old woman who had come down from the Mountains of the Moon tribe, with her whole family, to run their commissary, must have heard rumors in the wind. She had a food package gathered up for two, some gourds full of sweet water, and a big sandwich of roasted African buffalo meat and millet bread.
and she stood right there in front of Johnny until he began eating it. Sir Robert picked up the food package and Dunnel Dean the gourds, and they walked past the old cyclo operations office. There was hammering and drill whirring still coming from the plane area, where Angus was making sure it was all operational. Johnny picked up a few yards of radio printer paper and glanced at current traffic, looking for any unusual weather in the pilot crosstalk. Well, well. One, two, yes, two mentions of the craft that got as big as the sky. Story similar to the one Stormalong had told him. The small gray man mentioned in both. India, South America. The small gray man gets around, murmured Johnny. Dunnel Dean and Sir Robert craned around to the printout to see what he was talking about. Stormalong will tell you, said Johnny. Earth certainly was of interest to some other civilization in space. But the small gray man didn't seem hostile, at least not yet. Keep this or any other base you go to defended on a 24-hour basis, said Johnny. The whirring and hammering had stopped, and they went to the plane. It was being dollied to just inside the open hangar door. Stormalong was standing there with his co-pilot. You stay here, said Johnny, both of you. You, he jabbed a finger into Stormalong's chest, be me. Go on that same route every day in my clothes and throw rocks. And you, he pointed a finger at the co-pilot, a Scot they called Darf, be Angus.
I'm no good at other things Bonnie Angus kens, wailed the co-pilot.
You do them, said Johnny. A Russian came running in from outside and told them it was all clear, no drones coming. Not on screens or eyeball. His new English had a colloquial Scotch accent. Johnny and Angus got in the plane. Sir Robert and Dunnel Dean threw the food and water in. Then they both stood there looking up at Johnny. They were trying to think of something to say, but both of them were unable to talk. Biddy stood back. He waved a timid hand. Johnny shut the plane door. Angus gave him a thumbs up. Johnny signaled the dolly crew to shove them out and pushed the heavy starter buttons with his fists. He looked back. The crews and people in the hangar door weren't waving. Johnny's fingers shoved into the console buttons. Stormalong watched breathlessly in the door. He had known Johnny was a flyer unequaled, but he had never seen a battle plane vault upward so fast and sharply and rush into hypersonic so quickly. The bottom of the broken sound barrier rocketed back at them as it echoed against the African peaks. Or was that the boom of the storm that engulfed the speeding ship? A roll of thunder and a lightning flash. The group in the hangar door still stood there, looking at the place where the ship had vanished into the cloud-boiling sky. There Johnny was on his way to America fast. They didn't like it. Not any part of it. 6. It was dark when they landed at the old academy. They had flown close to the North Pole, rolling back the sun and arriving before dawn. There were few lights. No one had lighted the field, for it was not the operational field of the area, and they had slipped in on instruments and view screens. The cadet duty officer was sound asleep, and they woke him to get themselves logged in.
Stormalong Stan Stavanger, pilot, and Darth McNulty, co-pilot, returning from Europe. Student battle plane 862-90-567918. No troubles, no comments.
The cadet duty officer wrote it down. He didn't bother to get them to sign it. Johnny didn't know where Stormalong and Darf had been berthed. He had not remembered to find out. Stormalong probably in senior faculty berthing. Darf? He thought fast. Darf was still carrying the overgenerous heavy food bag and a tool kit. After all, Stormalong was their ace here. Abruptly, Johnny grabbed the food bag and tool kit and shoved them at the cadet.
Please carry these up to my room for me.
The cadet looked at him oddly. Even Stormalong did his own fetching and carrying in this place.
We've been flying for days with no sleep, said Johnny,
faking a reeling motion. The cadet shrugged and took the bundles. Johnny waited for him to lead off, and he did. They arrived at a separate bedroom and went in.
Stormalong's, all right. It had a Norwegian woven picture on one wall. Stormalong had made himself comfortable. The cadet dropped the food bag and kit on the table and would have left, but although Angus was the one who had put this base together originally and knew it inside out, he wouldn't have known where Darf was berthed. Hastily, Johnny grabbed half the food and the kit and put them back into the cadet's arms. "Help Darf get to his room." The cadet looked like he was going to protest.
"He hurt his arm playing Skittles," said Johnny. "Looks like you hurt your face too, sir," said the cadet.
He was quite sullen at losing his sleep, but they went off. Fine beginning, thought Johnny. About now, Sir Robert definitely would be talking about planning raids right. "You plan a raid," he would be saying. One as dangerous as this one might be certainly hadn't wasted any planning time. The cadet and Angus didn't come back, and he had to suppose it had been successful. He stripped off his clothes and rolled into Stormalong's bunk. He forced himself to go to sleep. He would need it. It seemed like only seconds later that he was alarmed awake with a shake of the shoulder. He sat up suddenly, hand going under the blanket to his blast gun. A face mask. A breathe mask. The hand was a paw.
"Did you deliver my letter?"
whispered Care. It was broad daylight. A late morning sun was streaming in through the discolored glass of the window. Care stepped back, looking at him oddly. Then the midget cyclo cat-footed over to the door to be sure it was closed, looked around the room for bugs or other surveillance devices, and came back to the bed where Johnny had swung his legs down. Care guffawed.
"Is it that plain?" said Johnny, a little cross and smoothing his hair out of his eyes. "Not to an unobservant idiot," said Care, "but to one who had sweated on as many driver's seats and in as many shafts with you as me, I know you, Johnny."
He swatted his paw into Johnny's palm.
"Welcome to the deep pit, Johnny. I mean, Johnny logged in as Stormalong. May the ore fly and the carts roll."
Johnny had to grin at him. Care was always such a clown, and in a way he was fond of him. Care stepped very close. He whispered,
"You know, you could get yourself squash killed around here. The word trickles out through the cracks in the bunkroom doors. Top, high-level bunkrooms. You and me, too, if they trip the latch on us. Caution is the word. You ever have a criminal background? No? Well, you will have when they get through with you. Good thing you're in the hands of a real criminal, me. Who came with you? Who's Darf now?"
"Angus McTavish," said Johnny. "Ooh-hoo! That's the best news of the day, next to your being here. Angus has a way with the nuts and bolts. I keep track of things. What's first?"
"First," said Johnny, "I get dressed and eat some breakfast. I'm not showing my face in that dining room. Stormalong trained most of these flying cadets."
"That he did, while I trained the machine operators. You know, I've been doing a great job on that, Johnny."
Johnny was dressing, but Care, the chatterbox, rattled on.
"This academy is the most fun I ever had, Johnny. These cadets, I tell them stories about teaching you and things you did, mostly lies, of course, and made up to make them do better, and they love it. They know their lies. Nobody could blade scrape 39 tons of ore an hour, but you understand. You know me, I love this job. You know, it's the first time I've been really glad I'm a midget. I'm not much taller than they are, and I got them... Johnny, this will kill you unless somebody else does it first. I got them believing I'm half human."
He had taken a seat on the bed, which sagged under his 700 pounds, and now it almost collapsed as he rolled around in laughter.
"Ain't that rich, Johnny? Half human, get it? I tell them my mother was a female cyclo that raped a Swede."
Johnny, in spite of the seriousness of their mission, had to smile. He was getting into Stormalong's clothes. Care had stopped laughing now. He was just sitting there, looking pensive.
"You know, Johnny,"
and he sighed so that his breathe mask valve fluttered and popped,
"I think this is the first time in my life I ever had friends."
Eating a few bites of breakfast and chasing it down with some water, Johnny said, "First thing you do is go down to the Academy Commandant and tell him you want Stormalong and Darf assigned at once to your special project. I'm sure they gave you authority from upstairs."
Oh, I got authority, said Care. I got authority running out of my furry ears. And upstairs is all over me to finish that breathe gas circulator. But I told them I needed help and parts from the Cornwall mine site.
Good, said Johnny. Tell them Dunnell Dean will be over in a couple of days to replace Stormalong in the training schedule. Say you arrange that, too, to keep the school from disruption. Then you get a closed ground car out in front of this building, get Darf in it, and come back here and knock on my door and we're away.
Got it,
said Care as he went rumbling off. Johnny checked his blast gun and put it inside his coat. He would know within an hour or two whether Care was playing this straight. Until then? 7. They got to the car without incident, beyond a couple of sly cracks from passing cadets, such as,
"Had a crash, Stormy,"
in reference to the bandage, and, "Wipe one out, Stormalong," or was it that lass in Inverness, or her daddy? There was a big package in the car, making seating tight even in cyclo seats. Care swept the car out across the rolling plain with the effortless skill of one with years and tens of thousands of hours on a console behind him. Johnny had not remembered how well Care drove. Better than Turrell on ground cars and machinery.
"I told them," he said, "that it was you two that had gone to fetch the housing needed from Cornwall. I was even seen to unload it from your plane."
Nothing like having an experienced criminal along, Johnny commented. It tickled Care, and he cranked up the ground car to 150. On this rough plain? Angus had shut his eyes tight as the shrubs and rocks whooshed by.
"And there's two air masks and bottles I brought," said Care. "We'll claim breathe gas is leaking in the pipes. Not enough for me, too much for you. Put them on."
They deferred it, however, until they were near the compound. Chinko air masks, cut down to fit a human, were a mite uncomfortable at any time. Johnny didn't care about the speed. He took an instant to glory in the beautiful day. The plains were a bit brown, and the snow a trifle less on the peaks at this season. But it was his country. He was tired of rain and humid heat. It was sort of good to be home. He snapped out of it suddenly as they screeched to a slow in billowing dust on the plateau near the cage. Care didn't care where he went in a vehicle. Care leaned out the window and yelled at the cage,
"It came. I don't think it's the right housing, but we'll see."
Turrell. There he was, paws on the bars. They had the electricity off.
"Well, speed it up," roared Turrell. "I'm tired of being roasted in this sun. How many days yet, you crap brain?"
2, 3, no more, yelled Care.
He shot the vehicle into a perilous reverse and it spun up in the air about 7 feet and came down driving toward the other side of the compound to enter the garage doors. Care shot in and spun the car down a ramp into a deserted sector and stopped.
"Now we go to his office," he said.
"Not yet," said Johnny, hand on the blast gun inside his coat. "Remember that old closet where they first imprisoned Turrell?"
"Yes,"
said Care doubtfully. "Is it still rigged with breathe gas?" said Johnny.
"I guess so," said Care.
"First drive by the electronics storeroom and pick up a mineral analysis machine, and then drive to that closet." Care was a bit uneasy.
"I thought we wanted into his office."
"We do," said Johnny. "But we got a little business first. Don't be alarmed. The last thing in the world I would want to do is hurt you. Relax. Do what I said." Care revved up and shot the car through the mazes of ramps on its way to do as Johnny said. The place had not been much cleaned up since the battle, but hundreds of planes were still there, the thousands of vehicles and mining machines, the dozens of shops for various types of work, and hundreds of storerooms. The bric-a-brac as well as the valuables of 1,000 years of operation. Johnny looked at them speculatively. They were wealth for this planet, in the way they could be used to rebuild it. And every mine site had huge and similar stores of material. These things should be preserved and cared for. They were irreplaceable, since the factories that had made them were universes away. But plentiful as they were, they would run out and wear out eventually. another reason to join the community of stellar systems. He doubted that much of this was made on Cyclo. The Cyclos were exploiters of alien races and terrain. Hadn't they even borrowed their language and technology? Teleportation seemed to be the key to their power. Well, he was working on that. They drew up before the old closet, and Angus struggled in with the mineral analysis machine. Johnny fiddled with the breathe gas circulator. They checked their own air masks and shut the door. They told Care to take his mask off. Care, a trifle apprehensive, yet had the presence of mind to pull out a wad of black waste and block the viewport. Johnny and Angus went right to work. They persuaded Care to put his head on the mineral analysis plate. He did, but he kept rolling his amber eyes up at them sideways as though he thought they were a bit crazy. He recalled the machine's use on Johnny, and he tried to tell them that he had never been shot in the head much. They worked. Angus had become very expert in adjusting these machines, and he twiddled knobs for different depth settings and focuses. Care was getting a crick in his back, bending over, and said so. They shushed him. They turned his head in every direction on the plate. At the end of a sweating 35 minutes, they let him up. Care stood there, rubbing his neck and trying to get his spine straight again. Johnny looked at him. "Tell us about your birth, Care." Care thought this was a bit mad. He opened his mouth to speak, and then glanced at the door. He took a device out of his pocket and plunked it against the area beside the viewport. It had a little light sphere on it, and would tell them whether anyone was standing outside. Angus checked the intercom set into the panel and turned it off. "Well," said Care, "I was born of wealthy parents." "Oh, come on, Care," said Johnny. "Truth. We want the truth, not some fairy tale." Care looked a little offended. He sighed in a martyred fashion. He took out a miniature box flask of Kerbango and chewed off a small piece. He needed that. He hunkered down against the wall and began all over again. "I was born of wealthy parents, on Cyclo," said Care. "The father was named Ka. It was a very proud family. His first female gave birth to a litter. Usually, a Cyclo litter is 4 pups, sometimes 5. In this case, it was 6. Well, it often happens that when there's that many pups, one of them is a runt. Not enough space in the female organs or something. So anyway, I was the 6th pup and a runt. Not wanting the family disgraced, they threw me out in the garbage, that being the usual treatment for such. A family slave, for his own reasons, fished me out and took me away. He was a member of an underground revolutionary organization. There are miles of abandoned mine shafts under the Imperial City, and slaves escape into them and nobody can keep them policed, so there I was. Maybe that's why I'm at home in the mines. The slaves were of the Balfin race, blue-colored people. They aren't exactly ordinary-looking. They can breathe gas, the cycloatmosphere, and don't have to wear masks, and so they can be seen easily in the streets. Maybe they had an idea they needed a cyclo of their own to plant bombs or something. But anyway, they brought me up and trained me to steal things for them. I could slip in and out of small places, being so small. When I was about 8, which is pretty young for a cyclo, an Imperial Bureau of Investigation agent named J. Ed infiltrated the group with what they call agent provocateur, to provoke them to commit big crimes so they could be arrested. The IBI raided the underground after a while. Being small, I got out through an old ventilator shaft. I was hungry after that and just wandering in the streets. So I found a small window in back of a goo food ship. It was too small to be barred, for no normal cyclo could get in. So I crawled through and tripped an alarm system, a fact that encouraged me later to learn all about such things. Care paused and took another small chew of Kerbango. Actually, it was a welcome break for him. One can't handle Kerbango wearing a breathe mask, for you can't spit out the small grainy residue. It was kind of a relief to him as well. He'd never told the story before. "Anyway," Care continued, "they tried me and found me guilty and sentenced me to be branded with the 3 bars of denial and a century of service in the Imperial pits. There I was, 8 years old, at hard labor with hard criminals. I was too small to fit any of their shackles, so they just let me run around,
and that's why I haven't any shackle marks on my ankles. I don't have to be careful when I take off my boots. Because I was foot loose, the older criminals could use me to carry illegal messages between the chain gangs and cells, and they educated me pretty thoroughly in crime. When I was about 15, there was a plague hit the pits, and a lot of guards died, and having no shackles, I escaped. By this time, I knew my business, even though 15 is pretty young for a cyclo. Being small, I could get in and out of windows and cubbyholes nobody thought to bar, and I collected myself a lot of ready cash. I bought false identity papers, bribed an intergalactic mining company personnel clerk, and got myself employed as a shaft man because I could get in and out of small places. I served in various systems for the company and have somehow gotten along for the last 25 years. I'm only 41, and a cyclo lives to be about 190, so I got 149 years to go. The immediate problem is how I plan to spend it.
Thank you, said Johnny. What leverage does Turl have on you?
That ape? None now. He did have, but not now. None, praise the devils.
Were you ever trained in math? Asked Johnny. Care laughed.
No, I'm dummy at it. All I am is a practical engineer. No education, but experience. And crime, of course.
Do you like cruelty, Care? The midget cyclo hung his head. He looked ashamed in the reflected light from the machine.
As long as I'm being honest, which is a novelty, I can tell you, I have to pretend to like cruelty to get my fun out of hurting things. Otherwise, other cyclos would consider me abnormal. But no, I don't like it, I'm sorry to say.
He roused himself.
Say, Johnny, what's all this about?
Angus and Johnny looked at each other. This cyclo didn't have any objects in his head. None at all. But Johnny was not going to let go of vital data. Care didn't know about such objects, and probably very few cyclos did. You've got a different skull structure from other cyclos, said Johnny. You are completely different. Care jerked into alertness.
Is that a fact? Well, well. I often felt there was some difference.
He became pensive.
Cyclos don't like me, and actually I don't like them. I'm glad to have the reason.
Johnny and Angus were very relieved about their test. They didn't want Care attacking them and committing suicide when he realized they were seeking the answer to the riddle of teleportation. They were just gathering up their gear when the telltale on the door flashed. Somebody was just outside. 8. Care got on his breathe mask. He tiptoed over to the machine and picked it up, using only one arm. Then he tiptoed over to the door and suddenly swung it open as though walking out. A wave of breathe gas burst out of the room. Lars was standing there, frozen in the act of attaching a listening device to the door. He wore no air mask. The invisible puff of breathe gas hit Lars full in the face. He must have been in the act of taking a breath at that moment, for he rose on his toes like someone being strangled. He gagged. He reeled back. He fought for air. He started to turn blue. In another few seconds, he would start into convulsions. Johnny and Angus grabbed him, one on each arm, and rushed him back to clearer air. Angus fanned him with a metal plate he'd found on the floor. Gradually, Lars came back to life. The blue tinge faded. But what he said was,
"What were you doing in there?"
And he said it angrily.
"Now, now, laddie," said Angus soothingly. "Here we are saving your life, and you're making mean sounds."
Lars was looking at Johnny with a peculiar expression on his face. Johnny went over to where Care was rattling the housing around in the car as though he had just put it there.
"It's all right now," said Care. "No cracks or metal faults in the housing. We better go see if it fits."
They drove off and left Lars lying there, gazing after them with that peculiar look.
"Why's he looking at me that way?" asked Johnny. "You better be careful," said Care. "He's a crazy one, and he's the Council's long nose and pry. He's got some idea that somebody named Bitter or Hitter was the greatest military leader in your history, and if you stand still for 10 seconds, he'll begin on you. It's some church. There's nothing wrong with religion, but plenty wrong with what he says. Turl wrecked his wits. But there wasn't much there in the first place. Ha ha.
But why that peculiar look at me? Asked Johnny.
Natural suspicion, said Care. Say, you know, I feel a lot better since talking to you creatures. I sure am glad I'm different.
They stopped and got out below the top compound level where Turl's office was. They removed the housing from the car and struggled up the ramp with it. Just before they went in, Angus stopped them.
Why couldn't Turtle fix this place up himself?
Care laughed.
When Johnny left here, he said to spread it that the place was booby-trapped. But that isn't all of it.
He indicated the door to Turl's office with a paw wave.
If the Cyclos got out from the dormitory section, they could come here and kill anybody working here. Turl's pretty sure they'd kill him if they got loose. They hate him.
Wait, said Johnny. That means Turl will get them killed before he moves in here. He put a hand on the door latch to the office. You did debug this place and look for booby traps.
Ha ha, said Care. I had been tearing this place to bits waiting for you.
They went in and set the housing down. Indeed, the place was a wreck. Wires pulled out, the old breathe gas circulator scattered in bent pieces on the floor, desks and chairs askew, paper thrown about. Johnny looked it over. At once he saw that in Turl's inner office, the whole lower section of the wall to the right of Turl's desk, as he would sit at it, was lined with large locked compartments. Been into those? He said. Care shook his head.
No keys. A security chief loves his security.
Johnny sent Angus out to find a sentry. The cadets were still the guards in this compound. Care, with his blanket authority, repeated what Johnny whispered to him and sent for Chirk. They got to work sorting out wires and papers and trash, and presently three cadet sentries showed up with Chirk. She was a long way from the smart-looking secretary of the old days. They had her on three chain links attached to a collar. Her fur was all the wrong way. There was no powder on her nose bone and no polish on her triple-jointed claws. She wore just a cloth thrown around her shoulders, no other clothes.
Where's the keys? Said Care, as prompted.
Keys. Everybody wanted keys.
Her voice was punctuated with fang clicks and snaps and hisses.
It wasn't enough. Turl brought them all to this and sought to ruin her company record by saying she was disobedient and didn't follow orders. But she had to be dragged all over, in chains, just to say, what keys now? That day of the battle, Turl provoked, everybody had been after the keys, keys, keys. Her company duties...
Johnny was quietly whispering in Care's ear. Care whispered back,
you trying to start a riot?
But as Johnny insisted, Care said loudly to Chirk,
shut up. Just because Turl plans to murder all of you down there is no reason to take it out on us.
Chirk went very still. Through the face mask glass, her eyes got very round. The flutter valve of the mask started pumping rather quickly. Johnny whispered again, and Care said,
it might or might not make any difference, but when he moves in here and has free rein of this whole compound, he will be furious with you if the keys aren't found.
The muscles in the middle of her body, where her heart was, were twitching and leaping. The flutter valve stopped totally for half a minute, then started again.
He's moving in here,
she said, so quietly it was hard to hear her through the mask.
Why else are we fixing it up? Said Care.
Then, menacingly,
where's the keys to those wall doors?
Chirk shook her head.
He never let anybody have them. They're maybe gone.
Was that a sob in her breath?
Well, take her away, said Care gruffly to the guards.
They dragged her off.
What's going on here?
Demanded Lars, popping up in the door.
We're trying to find the access panels to the wiring, snapped Care. It's all shorted out.
There were breathe gas vials scattered around. Johnny reached behind his back and turned one on. Angus, Care, and himself were wearing masks. Care was reaching in his pocket. He pulled out a handful of items and shoved them at Lars.
This is a dangerous job. I demand a higher bonus. These were in the first wiring recess.
Lars looked at them. Three were dented bullets that looked like radiation ammunition, but weren't. Another was a bent time fuse of the kind set in small blast holes. The biggest was a wad of malleable explosive compound.
"Somebody has been getting into this office," said Kerr. "After this, I want the door locked. I want nobody in or out of here but us, and I want you miles away before you kill yourself and get me blamed for it. I know how you work."
Lars was beginning to cough again from the new breathe gas coming out of the vial.
"See," said Kerr, "these ducts are still loaded with breathe gas and it leaks."
Lars was backing out into the hall, still coughing. He lifted the objects that had been put in his hand.
"Are these dangerous?" "Take them and throw them at your betters and find out," said Kerr. "And if I see you around here again, I'll tell them you are slowing down this job by issuing orders to take it easy. Get out, go away, stay out. And if I see your face again, you will have to find another expert. Got it? I'll quit."
Lars looked at Johnny in a very peculiar way. But at that moment, from the direction of the distant dormitory three levels down, came some angry howls and snarls. Lars rushed off.
"Did you really find those items in here?" said Angus.
"Of course not," said Kerr. "Shut, lock, and bar those doors out there, and let's get to work. The last place Turl will want to be for now is in this compound. After we're finished and he's sent somebody else to see whether they get blown up is the first he'll want to see of this place."
He listened to the distant howls and roars.
"You sure started a riot, Johnny. Turl will hear that clear out in the cage. That chirk really told them."
Johnny barred and locked the outer doors, and then gestured from Angus to the wall cabinet locks, and Angus whipped out a small set of picks and went to work on them. They were in business. Chapter 20 1 Their problem was really bugging the place more thoroughly than any place had ever been bugged, while still preventing the bugs from being discovered by one who, although quite mad, was one of the sharpest security chiefs ever to walk out of the mine schools. If they did this well, they would have a total record of the technology of teleportation and its mathematics. They would know what happened to Cyclo, because they would be able to cast out picto-recorders. They would know the whereabouts and possibly the intentions of other races. They would be in communication with the stars and universes and could defend themselves on Earth. Turl would have to work out and build from scratch a whole transshipment console, for the one out there near the old platform was a burned-out ruin. They needed devices that could read over his shoulder every book he opened, every page of figures he made. They needed to fix up his workroom in his office and rig it so that every resistor he picked up, every wire he put in, would be recorded exactly. It was certain that he would sweep the place with a probe before every work period and possibly after every day of toil. He would be meticulous in his bug detection. If Turl had any inkling the technology would be observed, he would not start. If he thought it had been taken away by an alien, he would commit suicide. For there was no doubt that Turl had in his skull both the devices they had found in the dead cyclos. Before they had left Africa, Dr. McKendrick had been very pessimistic about being able to remove such brain devices from all that bone and still have a live, functioning cyclo on his hands. That chance was not entirely gone, but it was nothing to be counted on. Angus had lately begun to understand why Johnny had kept Turl alive, why they didn't just get out some battle planes and wipe this new political mess out. It was a very delicate situation. It was a thin chance. It had to work. But with what risks? Angus had no doubt whatever that Johnny was holding his own life at stake. A huge and dangerous risk. But what a prize. The cyclo technology of teleportation. Earth depended upon it. Johnny was a cool one, Angus thought. He himself would never have that much patience, or be able to retain that detached an overview of the entire scene without permitting personal considerations from entering in. Angus looked up from the locks.
He was in awe of Johnny as he thought about what they were doing. These people or Turl would kill Johnny in a flash if they found him or knew what he was up to. Robert the Fox had denounced it as folly and a hopeless, unwarranted risk. Angus didn't think so. It was a brand of courage he had never seen before. He got the cabinets opened. They contained all the paraphernalia a security chief ever thought he would need. They contained papers and records Turl would consider vital. Johnny was looking for super-confidential notes on teleportation or its odd mathematics. On his inspection, he did not find anything on those subjects beyond normal tests. But he did find an item of interest. It was a record of all the mineral deposits left on Earth. The company had not made a mineral survey for itself for centuries, content with their originals. But Turl had. Johnny smiled. There were 16 loads of gold on the planet, almost as good as the one they had mined. In the Andes and the Himalayas, they just weren't that close to home, and it would have been more public to have mined them. Ah, yes. All these other loads were also associated with uranium. There were thick records of Earth's existing mineral resources. Hundreds of years of security chiefs had continued to log the findings of the drones, which were used for security but were essentially mineral spotters. The company, with its semi-core methods of mining, could go down almost to the molten core, to the very bottom of the crust, without breaking through. And they were content to mine what they had and conserve their assets of unmined wealth. Turl had simply removed the records from company view for his own purposes. Ores, metals. The planet was still wealthy in resources. Johnny recorded every page rapidly. This was not what he was here for, but it was nice to know their planet had not been bankrupted of minerals. They would need them. Angus had found what they were really looking for just now, Turl's bug probe. It was an oblong box with an aerial sticking out of it and a disc cup on the tip of the aerial. It had on-off switches for various frequencies and light domes and buzzers. Johnny had done his apprenticeship well in the electronics shop. He knew that no wave this could detect would pass through lead or a lead alloy. Ordinarily, this would not be a factor since any bug of any kind whatsoever would also not pass through lead. Therefore, why detect it since it wouldn't work as a bug or button camera if it had lead over it? The first job was to rig these switches. Johnny made a trip to electronics stores and got what he wanted. He came back to find that Care had swept the area for bugs and found none. They chose where Turl would do his shop work, in Chirk's former reception office. It was big enough to work in, and the size console it would go in and out of the door. While Johnny, at his desk, worked on the bug probe, the other two rigged a workbench out of a metal slab and welded it to the floor, and then armor annealed the welds, so it would be an awful lot of trouble to move. They even got a stool and put it in front of it. When they had finished, they had a very nice layout. Johnny moved his work over to it. He had made excellent progress. Using micro-button transmitters employed normally in remote controls, he had rigged every switch in the probe so that when it was turned on, it would send out an impulse from the remote relay. These relays took a microscope to see properly. They were fastened in with a small molecular spray. The worst part was getting them to stay where one wanted them while spraying them down. But the eye that could detect them unaided had never been made. Using a scope set at a distance from the probe, he clicked each switch on in turn, and the scope bounced in response. The next part was hard because it involved the adaptation of iris sleeves taken from tubes of plane viewers. These were small devices that automatically adjusted the volume of a light path. They would close their concentric leaves from wide open to shut. They had to take these delicate things apart and spray them, molecules thick, with lead and reassemble them so they would not only work, but would go on working, opening and closing. Angus was the best at this sort of work. Then they got some contraction rings and put them around these leaded irises and installed micro-buttons in them to activate them. When they had built about 15 of these, they made a thorough and extensive test.
When the probe was clicked on, the iris instantly closed. When the probe was turned off, the irises sprang open. In other words, the leaded irises would be shut whenever the probe was on,